You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
During the 11 seasons of The Carol Burnett Show, Ms. Burnett made millions of Americans laugh at sketches like Went with the Wind and As the Stomach Turns. But Carol Burnett is also the mother of three girls, and her oldest, Carrie, overcame her drug addiction as a teenager and then went on to become a writer, actor, and director before she died of cancer at the very young age of 38. In her latest book, Carrie and Me, A Mother-Daughter Love Story, Carol Burnett writes about her remarkable daughter's life and work. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that has brought Carol Burnett back to our show. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard.
Carrie was born in 1963, and you write about giving birth. Why did you try to leave the hospital in the middle of labor?
Well, I went into labor, and my husband and I went to the hospital, and they I got undressed, and they put me in one of those beautiful robes, you know, open at the back, and put me in the bed that had bars, you know, that they pull up and all, and they examined me, and they said to my husband, "Go home. It's going to be quite a while. And we'll call you when the time is near." So now I'm lying there, and they gave me a shot or something. So I'm feeling okay.
Epidural, most likely.
No, not then. It wasn't an epidural. But it was a shot, to, like, I don't know, calm me down or whatever, you know. And I thought, well, I'm fine. And I'm hearing a woman next door to me screaming, "Get this thing out of me!" Like that. And then another one on the other side was saying, "Oh, Dios, 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 you know, God, 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 help." And I'm thinking, what's their problem? I mean, gee whiz, you know, I'm fine. I've got a little pain here and there. So, well, and I kind of drifted off to sleep. And then I woke up, and the pains were coming pretty hard. And I thought, well, this is ridiculous. But I was drunk from that shot they'd given me.
This is your first child.
Yes. So I put the bars down, I got out, I opened the closet door, I'm putting on my dress, my coat, my hat, it was winter, and I was just putting on my boots when the nurse came in. Her name was Louise, I remember, and she said, "Mrs. Hamilton, what are you doing?" I said, "I'm leaving." And she said, what? I said, "Look, I didn't feel like this when I came in. So I won't feel like that when I leave." It's the building, I thought was. And, of course, I was drunk as a skunk. And she got me undressed again and put me, you know, back into bed. But then, as I say in the book, all of that pain and misery and everything that you do feel when it's near went away when I saw her, when I saw my baby.
And that she was 3 years old when you began doing the show, the Carol Burnett Show.
Yes.
And she was an early teen when it ended.
Yeah.
So she was kind of growing up with the show.
Yes. The girls would come, when they were old enough, they would come to the dress rehearsals every Friday and watch the show and get their pictures taken with our guest stars.
From an early age, it seemed that you couldn't force Carrie to do things. Did that continue as she got older?
Well, I didn't want to force her. I tried to force her into learning how to walk.
I mean, she was fairly strong-willed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, learning how to walk. I wanted her to walk by her first birthday, so I tried to force that. That didn't quite work, and then I realized I have to kick back. And are you referring now to when she was older, like 12, 13?
Well, she kept on. She was always kind of strong-willed, but I was thinking more like she's the first, and I know I'm the eldest in my family.
Yeah.
And my mother kind of learned how to be a mother with me.
Yes.
Which caused great resentment later when, when the other kids came along, and I said, "Well, you didn't let me do that."
Well, I actually, she was an easy kid. And we had a lot of fun together. And it wasn't until she started to get to be 13, 14 years old, which is a tough age for any kid, but maybe especially girls, I don't know.
Well, you're right about the penny hair salon that you set up for the girls one night.
Yeah. Well, the three girls, it was always an adventure when we had to take them out to dinner because one might be perfect, and the other two would be throwing food at each other or acting up or not wanting to eat or else all three would be awful, but never all three together would were little ladies, is what I meant. So we kind of decided we just weren't going to take them out to the local Italian restaurant for a long time because they wouldn't behave. And so I got an idea to open up a beauty parlor in my bedroom and bathroom, and I put a sign on the door. It said, beauty salon, come in for a hairdo, for shampoo and hairdo, one penny you have to pay. And then I put on a makeup coat, you know, and clothes.
You're doing a skit with your own kids.
I was. And they knocked on the door, and Carrie could read. She was the only one at that time because they were about seven and then down the line. And so I said, yes, madam, may I help you? And she said, she went along with, I would like a new hairdo. I said, fine, come in. Do you have a penny? Do you have, you know, so she gave me a penny. Now, the other two are waiting outside, right? And I sat her down in front of the little vanity, and I said, now, would madam like a page boy or a flip on her hair? And she opted for a page boy. So I washed her hair. This was the first time she didn't complain about soap or anything getting into her, you know. And she sat still. I did the blow dry on her hair. She looked great. I said, now, madam should go pick out a nice dress for dinner. She did. Now, the other two followed suit. I think Jody opted, my middle daughter, for a flip, and then Aaron for a page boy again. And each one went and picked out a nice dress to wear for dinner. So we're waiting downstairs for them. They come down looking like they're stepping out of a bandbox. They were so cute. And dinner, they were perfect because of the way they were dressed and the way their hair was done. Because we usually would just stick them in a, you know, a little sweatsuit or something to go to dinner. But they were all... So I really think that people, in general, act differently when they're dressed differently.
And in the old days, by the way, people used to dress to go out.
Mm-hmm.
To go to the theater or go to a restaurant.
Right. Even now, getting on an airplane.
Yeah. Well, so did you have to go through this every time you wanted to go out to eat?
Actually, I don't remember. I just remember that one time it was perfect.
But in a way, this is something that you as an actress had to understand because to some degree, costume helps you find your character.
That's my take on it. Now, there are characters like method actors go from the inside out. And people like me, you know, go from the outside in. Sometimes I didn't know how I was going to do a character or even what the voice would be until I would see how I was dressed. And I was acquainted with Sir Laurence Olivier. And he at one time talked about how he doesn't really know how he's going to play something until he does something to his nose, you know, put a bump on the nose or widen the nostrils or whatever it was. And then the character would come to him. So he worked from the outside in.
Now, Carrie excelled in elementary school, but then mm-hmm. her self-esteem seemed to go downhill.
Yeah.
And in the seventh grade, she asked you if she was ugly.
Yes.
That had to be a red flag.
Well, no, not really. I said, sweetheart, she had grown up so quickly. Excuse me. She had grown up so quickly. She was a tall drink of water. In fact, I'm going to have a drink of water right now.
A tall one, in fact.
I have a frog in my throat. Excuse me so much. Anyway, she was very tall. She was very skinny. Her hair was kind of stringy. And she had braces on her teeth. So she thought she was ugly. And I said, honey, you're going to turn into a butterfly. Don't worry. And I chalked it up to puberty.
Well, you had similar feelings when your kid. Most kids do, in fact.
Exactly. That's why it wasn't a red flag right away.
My guest is, in case you don't recognize that voice, I'd be surprised if you don't, is Carol Burnett, and she's written a memoir called Carrie and Me, a mother-daughter love story. You describe yourself and your husband, Joe Hamilton, as mm-hmm. being naive. Weren't most people fairly naive about drug use at the time?
I think so. And my parents were alcoholics, and I wish at that time, when I was growing up, that there was Al-Anon, you know, which would help. And there's Alateen now for kids, you know, who have parents with that disease. But that never happened. And I don't even remember that Al-Anon existed when Carrie started experimenting with drugs.
Was she going, getting them at school, or was she hanging out with a certain crowd?
I think so. And she was the best student early, all A's, the most popular. She always wanted to be the best at everything, so she became the best at doing drugs.
But her grades slipped.
Her grades started to slip, and we started to then wonder what's going on, and she became sullen. And it wasn't like Carrie, because she was always very open and a lot of fun. And she'd eat dinner very quickly and not talk at dinner that much with the kids and us, and run up to her room. And, you know, so we started to suspect something.
But do you think that if it were today, where people know a lot more about drugs and kids, that you probably would have spotted it a lot sooner?
Yes, I would think so. But
would that have helped?
Yeah. Yes, it would help, because then you could, you know, get on it right away and make sure that, you know, send your kids to rehab and get therapy and all of that.
Well, what kinds of drugs was she taking? This sounds like a lot than marijuana.
Oh, it was. It started with pot, and I found some in her room. I started to sneak around. And I was devastated. And she was about 14. And I told Joe, and I said, oh, my God, oh, dear, you know. And she came home from school, and we sat her down, and we talked to her, and I told her what I'd found and everything. And she was very upset. And we talked to her, and she said, oh, well, I won't do it again. I'm not a big user. I'm sorry. And, you know, well, there's a line that I heard once from a counselor in a rehab, said, how can you tell when an addict is lying? It's when they're opening their mouth and talking, you know. So, of course. And then she went on to heavier stuff. And we were, devastated. But finally, we went to a psychologist, and he recommended a rehab place in Texas. And so we sent her there. She didn't want to go, but we sent her there. And then after 30 days, there was family week, so all of us flew back, and she looked great. I mean, she had gained some weight. Her color had come back, and she was very sweet. And we went through all these counseling sessions and everything and came home feeling very positive. But she slipped before a year of being sober. She slipped again.
Partly, perhaps, because she was once again meeting with the same people who she had taken drugs with before. But do you think she was also an addictive personality? You mentioned your parents had been alcoholics, and Joe had been an alcoholic, your husband.
Yeah, and so she, what happened was that she started hanging out with the same people again and slipped again. And this time I was even more than devastated, because I had thought, oh, she's well, everything's fine, you know. And I knew at that time that I had to trick her, because she was 17. She was going to be 18, and I still had, you know, the parental thing going. And so I tricked her into going into another rehab in California, and she called me every name in the book. She was so angry. And I figured I had to love her enough to let her hate me. And that's kind of, you know, what I've said before to any kind of parents. Don't think you're going to try to be their best friend. Be their parent. And let them hate you. They're not really hating you. It's the drug inside and the demon inside, if you want to say, that is hating you.
And Joe also wound up in that rehab facility?
Yeah.
Because this was having such an impact on the family?
Right. And he started to drink again after many, many years. And so he was in the same hospital with Carrie.
My guess is Carol Burnett, her book, Carrie and Me, A Mother-Daughter Love Story, it's published by Simon & Schuster. Mm-hmm. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Carol Burnett. She's written a memoir called Carrie and Me, A Mother-Daughter Love Story. It has a photograph on it, the cover from, it says 1998.
1988.
Yeah. And the two of you look like you're having a lot of fun. Oh. And she looks very much like you.
Oh, thank you. She's a lot prettier. A lot.
Well, she also became an actress.
Yes.
Somewhere down the line. Mm-hmm. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Now, we were talking about the pressures that this situation was causing on the family. Mm-hmm. Your husband went into rehab for a little while. The mm-hmm. other kids must have also felt something terrible about what was going on.
They did. They loved their sister so much, and she loved them. But and then at one point, Jody and Aaron really resented us because we sent her to rehab, and they thought we were punishing Carrie, and all, you know, they were bonded together. And but then when
she was the older sister,
and they looked up to her, and so we went to Family Week. So there we were, Jody, Aaron, and me, having open session in front of other family members to where we would sit and talk about our fear face to face with the addict. And we talked to Joe talked to us, Carrie talked to us, we talked to Carrie talked to Joe, and Joe talked to Carrie, you know, about all of this, about how we were worried and how much we love each other, and the other person isn't allowed to say anything. So it was really, there wasn't a dry eye in the place.
But this is a turning point because
totally.
Both Carrie and Joe come out of this
in
better shape.
Yes. Yeah. I felt this one was going to take because she was different. She was getting sober for herself. She told me after she got out of this particular rehab that this lovely young doctor was doing therapy with her, you know, one-on-one sessions while she was in rehab. And she was complaining. She said, well, I want to be Janis Joplin. And he quietly said, well, she's dead. And Carrie said, like, oh, wow. You know, that kind of the penny dropped there.
From drugs.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
She could have wanted to be Jimi Hendrix and
exactly.
or Jim Morrison.
All of that, yeah. And she said,
that was a terrible time.
Yeah.
Well, do you think that your celebrity played a factor in all of this? Because they were they were living in a different world than most teenagers.
Well, where we lived, I mean, Jody's best friend was Dean Martin's daughter, you know, and I mean, his stepdaughter. And they all knew each other in school, so it wasn't like, you know, they were the only ones who had a parent who was a celebrity.
You made the decision to go public with it,
yes.
starting with a story on the cover of People magazine. Celebrities and others are more open about addiction struggles today, but that must have been a very brave thing to do in 1979.
Well, Leonard, I think it started out being selfish on my part. And all of us, because Carrie was going into rehab. That was going to certainly wasn't a secret. There are no secrets, and I didn't want the rags, the tabloids, to get a hold of this and throw it all out of proportion. So we decided to call People magazine and have it written the way we wanted it. You know, that the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, but as a result. A lot of people, we got so much mail and feedback from parents and so forth who were going through this that they stopped being afraid to talk about it. And Carrie went on to different high schools, and she spoke.
She became a public speaker.
She
actually
did.
Probably got her into show business in a way.
Well, she always played the piano and sang, even as a little kid. So I think it was in her genes anyway, but she came out and, you know, and talked about it. And then she went to Pepperdine College and got the lead in several of their theatrical productions, Barefoot in the Park and so forth. And she was on her way she was recovering, but and she had a goal now. She wanted to live and perform.
She played the character of Reggie on the TV series
yes.
Fame.
Uh-huh.
You guest starred on that.
yes, with Carrie.
One of those episodes. Was that the first time that you had performed together?
Yes, that was the first time. And she created that character of Reggie herself. By that, I mean she would wear boas, and she would put green streaks in her hair. And all. She was like the bohemian role, you know, in that series. And she became very popular with that.
You also became writing partners.
Yes, we did.
Was she the one who came up with the idea of writing Hollywood Arms, the Broadway
yes.
play that was based on your memoir, One More Time?
Yes, yes. She called me. She was living in, she loved Colorado, and she was had a little cabin that she kind of rebuilt herself. And she wrote me, and she said, "Mom, I love the memoir. I love the fact about your family and your grandmother and mama and my dad." She said, "Let's write a play just for the fun of it." And so I said, "Sure." So I would write in California, and she would write, and we would fax each other scenes. And she would take a certain scene, and then I'd say, "Well, I'll take the one where whatever happens." And so that's what we did, and then we sent 100 pages to Sundance, and Philip Hinberg, who was a theatrical head of Sundance for the theater department, he invited us to come up and work at Sundance, and they provided actors to read what we were doing and dramaturgs, and then we'd go back to our respective cabins and rewrite that night and then hear it read the next day by these wonderful actors. And so then we kept on, and there were a couple of directors that had been recommended to us, you know, for a theatrical production of it, possibly in New York. And my friend, Hal Prince, I called him and said, "Hal, do you know these two young directors?" And he said, "Yes, they're both very good." And he said, "Let me read what you've got, and I'll see which one might be best for your project." He read it, called back, said, "Would you mind if I directed it?" Hal Prince? Oh, my God. We were over the moon. And so we worked on it with him, and he would fax us notes and things back and forth. So I was in L.A., Hal was in New York, and Carrie was in Colorado. And we got a reading out of it, and Carrie, we were here, and that was good. And then we went back to the drawing board, and we were working on it even after Carrie had gotten diagnosed with cancer.
It takes a lot longer to put together a play than does a skit on television.
Oh yes, yes. A skit on television, what we would do, we would go in Monday and we were through on Friday, you know, so.
But I've always wondered why your skits were so much funnier than other people's skits.
Oh, thank
was
you.
It, well, it's hard. You know, I have a DVD of some of the best shows,
uh-huh.
your best shows.
Oh, thank you.
And it's impossible not to just laugh out loud every 2 seconds. Now, sitcoms are all quite different. They're mostly people with one-liners.
Right.
You really understood situations.
Right, right. I think today, as most of the sitcoms sound as if they were written by young teenage boys in a locker room, you know, they get very low. It's about sex or going to the toilet, you know. Mm-hmm. Those are the easiest jokes to write. The toughest jokes to write are character things. You know, when you look at All in the Family, there were no jokes really in that. It was all character driven. And the same thing with Newhart and same thing with Mary Tyler Moore.
Well, when you came out with a curtain rod on your shoulders.
That was Bob Mackie's genius, our costume designer.
Still,
yeah.
Immediate, incredible laugh, and then
yes.
everything follows from that.
Of course.
My guest is Carol Burnett. Her book, Carrie and Me, A Mother-Daughter Love Story, is published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You've included a complete story that Carrie wrote here.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you include it?
Well, when she was, she had been working, before she was diagnosed with cancer, she had been working on a story called Sunrise in Memphis about a young bohemian girl, not unlike Carrie, who takes a road trip to Graceland with a mysterious cowboy. And she decided that she would take the road trip by herself to get the soak up the vibes and so forth. So she packed up her Jeep and left Hollywood and was going on the same road trip that her character, Kate, would be going on. and she would email me scenes that she was completing on the road, and then she would also email me stories about people she met and what kind of adventures she was having as Carrie on her own.
And she made stops along the way to contact with the families.
Yes, past. Yes. She went to the San Antonio house where I was a wee little one. And because we were going, she also wanted to get some vibes about the fact that we were still writing the play about my growing up. And then she stopped in Arkansas, which was where my grandmother's roots were. And then she did the whole trip to Graceland. But she had written a beginning of Sunrise in Memphis, the ending of Sunrise in Memphis, but she had not completed all the middle part of the story. So when she was in the hospital for the last time, she asked me if I would finish the story for her. And I said, sweetie, they're your characters to write. I don't know. And she said, well, that's okay, Mom, you know. And then she passed away. And this request had been living with me for about 10 years. And I thought, I want to, you know, how am I going to do this? And so I thought, you know what? I really want people to get to know the daughter that she was and how optimistic and much and fun and talented and so forth. And that's why I started right even before she was born. I wanted everybody to get a picture, the readers, of her essence. And then I decided at the end, part two of the book, I would just put her story in there, even though it was incomplete.
You do include the email, some of the emails.
Yes.
That you also wrote to each other. Mm-hmm. Now, she died of lung cancer.
Yes.
Was she a heavy smoker?
Yes. And in fact, when she was in the hospital, this one morning I was sitting there, and she said, Mom, I'm so sorry. And I said, about what, sweetheart? And she said, for smoking.
So she understood that there had been this mm-hmm. direct link. The cancer moved from they do treat cancer, lung cancer.
Yes, they treated with chemotherapy and radiation.
But it spread to her brain?
Yeah.
That has to be dispiriting for anyone.
Oh.
How did she keep her spirits up?
Well, first of all, she would draw the tumor, and she would put it up on the hospital wall. And she named it, and it was ugly, this big old thing. And she named it Yucky Chucky. And then she had her heroes were the chemotherapy and radiation, and they were like Japanese cartoon figures, and she named them Chemo and Rady. And she would draw where they would attack Yucky Chucky, and Yucky Chucky kept getting smaller and smaller. And then when she was in radiology, she would wear she'd get that every Friday, and she would wear one of her boas, and she brought a mirrored ball, you know, one of those dance mirrored balls, and they hung it up in radiology, and then she brought some CDs, you know, and they would play really rock and roll music, and they would get down and start singing with the nurses, and some of the young doctors came in, and I remember she wrote me, she said, radiology rocks, Mom.
She died before the play premiered.
Yes.
But it started in Chicago?
Yes.
And then you came to Broadway?
At the Goodman Theater, and that was our tryout. And we came to Broadway the following fall.
And you were looking for signs that Carrie was with you as the play premiered.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find any?
Yes. I said a prayer on the plane, and I said, Carrie, you know, I had to finish this play because she died, so it was up to me to finish what we had started. And I said, honey, I'm going to need you. I'm going to need to feel that you're with me through the tryout in Chicago. Give me a sign, something. And so I arrived. I got into the room, a hotel room, and on the coffee table was this beautiful bouquet of birds of paradise. And I was her favorite flower. She even had it tattooed on her right shoulder, on the back, on her back. And I thought, whoa. And I called. Hal Prince sent me the Birds of Paradise, and I called him. I said, how did you know, Hal? He said, know what? I said, those were Carrie's. Well, he said, I didn't know. I just called up the florist and said, send something over exotic. And that was that. Then the next night, my husband and I took Hal out to dinner, and the maitre d' came up and had a bottle of champagne, complimentary, and he said, we would like to give you... And I looked at the label, and the label on it was Louise. That's Carrie's middle name, and my mother's name was Louise. And I thought, well, that's something. Then Carrie and I love rain. And so opening night, it poured. And so I thought, okay, I got three lovely signs. And my husband was so sweet. He went and got a water bottle and got the rain in it, and then later transferred it to a perfume bottle. So I still have it.
You started talking about your daughter's struggles with addiction in 1979. Mm-hmm. I wanted to let you know that our listeners have been writing in to thank you for sharing that with them again today.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
And just one more thing. Your birthday in a couple of weeks?
Yes. I can't wrap my head around it. I'm going to be the big 8-0, but I feel like I'm 11, so what the hell?
Well, happy birthday in advance.
Thank you.
Carol Burnett's book, Carrie and Me, A Mother-Daughter Love Story, is published by Simon & Schuster. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. My pleasure, Leonard.